I have a very limited goal. I hope 1 hour from now you have some better sense of what historically describes a religious, spiritual, political thrust, most often called nonviolence, and most often misunderstood. I hope that you have some better sense of what that meant when Martin Luther King biblically called a people to be nonviolent, or Cesar Chavez with the farm workers, or some better sense of Mahatma Gandhi, and finally, the source for all three of those people, some better sense of what our Lord was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, what he lived out, and what the symbol of the cross means to those of us who are called followers of the way. Those are not only historically linked, nonviolence, as we understand it, especially from the tradition of the three people that I just named, is eminently Christian, is a way to follow and be a disciple of Jesus Christ. There are always critics of a position. This has no end of critics. When there were some people who called into question the continued affluence and material conspicuous consumption in the United States, when there were some who began to call that into question, Spiro Agnew's writers, I do not believe he could have come up with this term himself. I don't think he was smart enough to do that. His writers gave him nattering nabobs of negativism. And I was one of those. I was a nattering nabob of negativism, which means I was calling into question this continued consumption that we had. Well, if you think the speechwriters have gone on limits to growth people, they have waxed eloquent on nonviolent people, and usually it's some combination of things that comes out as chicken, weak, cowardly, or just kind of withdrawn from society. Some accusation that they are not with it or that they're too scared to fight. Usually that's the way the criticism has come to nonviolence. In order for you to understand a little bit what we're talking about, I have to make one statement so that we clarify it. We're talking about possible response in a conflict situation. You could, for all of your life, never know whether you were willing to adopt a nonviolent stance or not. One of the ways is simply always to avoid conflict situations. That does not mean you're a disciple of nonviolence. It means you have successfully eliminated all conflict from your life. You probably also don't stand for very much. In other words, somebody who has never been in a conflict situation probably is somebody who says yeah to anything that anybody says, whether the first thing is contradictory to the second or not. They say yeah. Well, then maybe you could use the phrase nonviolence, but you would not be using it correctly. When we face conflict situations, it's normally thought that we have four options. I'm not sure those are the best words to describe them, but I think they give you the options. First one is the one that the world at least respects because it's thought of as being the one that at least stands up for something. In a conflict situation, one of the options is to fight. The exact opposite of that is also an option. Flight, run away. The other two get a little harder. There are shades of meaning to the other two. Neutrality is this attempt, anyway, not to get involved. I remember headlines when there was a woman in the courtyard of an apartment in New York State who was stabbed 6 times, didn't die until the 6th time, called for help each time. 37 people opened windows, looked, closed the windows, and went back into their apartment. Any time, in any of those 6 times when she called for help, 2 or 3 people coming out would have undoubtedly scared the assailant away, but the Kitty Genovese case is one of the times when lots of people chose to, quote, remain neutral. The last one is to cry uncle, to quit, to say, I surrender, capitulation, to give in, not to stand up for your rights, but to somehow give in. basically, if you study conflict situations, those are the four options. The reason I put them on the board is you will not understand what I'm trying to say tonight, and I think I'm being fairly accurate historically to the tradition of nonviolence. You will not understand it unless you draw a line underneath all four and say, as strongly as you can say it, none of the above. None of the above. Most people will easily say, well, you draw a line under fight, and nonviolence means I don't fight. But most people do not know that you're also saying no to those three. In fact, if you would do a free association with people, if we'd have started with that tonight, but then you'd have really been threatened. If I'd have started right off the bat with paper and pencil, I'd have lost you all to the hot sauna. If you ask people to free associate, I think you would find that nonviolence in most people's head is some combination of these three. Flight, capitulation, neutrality. Rather than saying none of the above, I think you will find people considering both pacifism as a stance and nonviolence some combination of those. So what I'm trying to do in 1 hour is to let you understand as clearly as I can, none of the above. Gandhi, in an attempt to make that clear, stayed away from the term nonviolence. I used it tonight because I don't think we have another one in our language. If there was some young person here who wanted a lifelong goal from this session, I would say you could be the first one to come up with a word that describes what we're talking about tonight, because so far no one has done it. If that's a challenge to you who climb mountains only because they're there, take it as a challenge. Gandhi did what I'm saying needs to be done in English. He, in his own language, there is a word for violence in his language. It's himsa. He could have, therefore, continued to talk about ahimsa. That would have been to be talking about nonviolence. In his language, the A makes it an antonym to the thing itself. Instead of that, he created a word. And I use that word over the microphone, so I'll... Satyagraha. There's another A in it. Satyagraha, or Satyagraha. It's hard to put into English. The main thing it does is to take it out of being a negative. Nonviolence says to us, in just the simplest kind of language, when we're not talking about any context to it at all, it tends to be the absence of fight. It tends to be the absence of violence. The one thing Satyagraha does is to make it a positive thing. It's truth power. But you have to read books to understand what Gandhi meant by truth. So that's a hard one. Soul power. In a religious group, you get into the old battle of body and soul. Maybe soul power is better able to be used since the Black Revolution in the last 20 years than ever before. If you didn't have any soul brothers and sisters, at least I hope you heard that phrase. And it's a stronger word than it used to be, soul power. Truth force, or soul force, or spirit force. All right, Gandhi created this in order to try to clarify what he meant in probably the most widespread Satyagraha attempt politically that we've had in recent years. Let me just read you a few quotes from Gandhi so that you get some sense of what I'm talking about. They translate this nonviolence because it's the only way they can do it. He's using Satyagraha each time. Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart. It must be an inseparable part of our very being. I know that this cannot be proved by an argument. It shall be proved by persons living it in their lives with utter disregard of the consequences to themselves. Our experience was that those who went to jail in a prayerful spirit came out victorious. Those who had gone on their own strength failed. There is no room for self-pitying in it either. When you say God is giving you the strength, self-pity comes when you do a thing for which you expect recognition from others. But here there is no question of recognition. Nonviolence is never a cover for cowardice. but it is the supreme virtue of the brave. Cowardice, being frightened, being scared, is wholly inconsistent with nonviolence. Nonviolence presupposes the ability to strike and the refusal to do so. It is better to be violent if there is violence in our hearts than to put on the cloak of nonviolence to cover our impotence. Violence is any day preferable to impotence, that's lack of power. There is hope for a violent man to become nonviolent. There is no hope for the impotent. If that surprises you at all, then maybe that's what you'll want to discuss a little bit. Gandhi said, those who are working for justice and choose violence to do it are far better than those who have capitulated and are not doing anything in the world for justice. He thought nonviolence was a higher way and was a stronger way, was a more radical way. But if there was a choice between working for justice or not working for justice, work for justice even if you have to be violent to do it. At the end of a long era in India, when most people thought that it was one of the strongest political successes for nonviolence, Gandhi said this, "I admit my mistake. I thought our struggle was based on nonviolence, whereas in reality it was really no more than passive resistance, which essentially is a weapon of the weak. It leads naturally to armed resistance whenever possible." Gandhi did not think he had succeeded, and he did not ever think nonviolence was passive or simply resisting passively rather than being active with satyagraha.
What's an example of passive resistance?
Simply refusing to fight. Simply remaining outside of the battle. Not going along with it, but not accomplishing, not moving toward your enemy in any way at all. Not being active in letting love conquer, but simply it had the value of refusing participation with evil, but it didn't move toward, in Jesus' words, didn't move toward your adversary and try to make a resolution of the thing. Clarence Jordan will have a few illustrations in the tape that'll help, because he has some...
No reconciliation as the goal.
Okay, no reconciliation as the goal of the action. Gandhi said that he got his understanding of nonviolence from the Sermon on the Mount and from Jesus. He also said that if he had found the Christian church faithful to the Sermon on the Mount and to Jesus, he would have become a Christian. Since he did not, he followed or tried to follow the Sermon on the Mount, but didn't go the route of becoming a Christian because he didn't find that the Christians who bore his name faithfully followed his way. If that upsets you, study Christian history, and I think you'll find that violence has changed us more than we have changed a violent world. I think Gandhi's indictment still stands. We have chosen the way of becoming part of the Christian church instead of simply refusing to do so because it hasn't always been faithful to Jesus, so I'm not saying I condone his final action, but I think that he had good reason for doing it. There is good reason for saying that an understanding of nonviolence is central to at least the early Christian church's understanding of who Jesus was and what it meant to be followers of the way. We've had some of the illustrations of that this winter. Probably the earliest Christian catechism, any of you still in catechism? No, okay. Probably the earliest Christian catechism was the Sermon on the Mount. So instead of starting with doctrine and at the end of catechism you could be, you knew all the answers or you didn't know all the answers, you probably for several years studied the way, what it meant to be followers of the way as described in the Sermon on the Mount. When you had decided yes, then there was a couple weeks, if Dan Erlander's research is correct, called the opening of the year, and you got your doctrine in a couple weeks, but you made your decision on whether or not nonviolence, turning the other cheek, all of that language that is familiar to us in the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, whether you could choose that as your way of life. In order to understand a little more biblically and to give you a break from my style and let you hear a Baptist preacher from Georgia, There's about 10-minute tape of Clarence Jordan summarizing nonviolence from the Bible. I want to introduce him in a minute and then let you listen to the tape. Clarence Jordan is dead now. He was a Baptist preacher, a PhD in New Testament studies. He was a good scholar. He remained close to the earth. His translations are called the Cotton Patch Version, and they're very earthy and homey and in the colloquialisms of Georgia farmers. He lived out a radical nonviolence for his whole life in the midst of racial hatred in Georgia, near Plains, where Jimmy Carter is from, by the way, Americus, Georgia. He lived out an integrated community called Koinonia Farms. He lived under constant pressure from a segregated society that just took intense dislike and abhorrence to the ideas of blacks and whites living together. Most nights, according to the stories of Clarence Jordan, he would get a phone call between 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and the phone call would be from some neighbors or some people near, and the phone call was almost always the same. Clarence, get the niggers out of the house. We're going to come and burn them all down. Then he had to make a decision almost every night. Was this another false alarm? Did he get everybody out of the house? When he did, they came by in pickup trucks and honked and laughed and shot a few guns in the air and went home, and then did you go back to sleep or not? Or was this the night they might do it and all the babies would die? Night after night, he lived nonviolently in the midst of that kind of thing, living out his understanding of the church as one and including blacks and whites. If he did come to one Luther League convention in the state of Florida in the old ALC Luther League convention days, and those who got to hear him then had a real treat. He was a fine example of someone who lived his faith. Always had a good sense of humor, always was confrontative. When he first moved there, all they knew was he was a Baptist preacher and was seminary trained, so he was invited to preach in the local Baptist church. And he took that occasion and he preached and he said, God loves all people, and they all said amen. So he thought, well, I better say that again. He said, all people, and they all said amen. And he said, blacks and whites, all people, and they all said amen. So Clarence Jordan shook hands with everybody at the door. The next week he came back with some of the black people from Koinonia Farms, and they never let him in. And all he said at the door was, what we said last week, we didn't mean this week. And he went home, and that was the beginning of the troubles for Koinonia Farm. Ironically, maybe fittingly, he got sick, and they couldn't get a doctor to come to Koinonia Farms because that's where the niggers lived. So it was 2 or 3 days until they got a doctor to come, and then it was too late. He lived out his faith, and I think is in the line of those that we're talking about tonight, who understood the love of Jesus. Always, Clarence Jordan's word was incarnational evangelism. The only evangelism is when you live out the faith, and then you got something to talk about. So Clarence Jordan will talk for about 10 minutes.
You have heard that it has been said to the old-timers, take an eye for an eye and take a tooth for a tooth. But I want to tell you all never to resist evil with evil. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other. I have found it even better if somebody slaps you on the right cheek to turn to him both heels. But and whoever wants to go to court with you and take away your shade, let him have your undershade. And whoever makes you go a mile, go with him too. Give to anybody who asks, and don't turn your back on the guy who wants to borrow from you. You all have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I want to tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who try to do you in, so that you might be sons of your spiritual Father. For he makes his sun to rise upon the wicked and the Don't even beatniks do that? And if you greet only your brothers, what is your distinctive? Don't even uncommitted people do as much? Now you people must be mature, just as your spiritual father is mature. Beyond all doubt, man's most vexing problem, from prehistoric times to the present, has not been how to pass a final examination. His most vexing problem has not been how to get a degree, a high-salaried job, to marry a beautiful girl and get a slick car and live in a swank house in the suburbs. These problems are but trivial in comparison to the problem of learning how to respond maturely to those who oppose us. We have learned how to respond to our friends, but to respond to our enemies, that is the problem. How can we be mature? How can we make a grown-up response to people who want to do us in, to hound us, to beat us, to persecute us? We would expect our Lord to be quite clear in his teachings on this subject, and he was. He begins by going deep back into history and digging up various responses that men have made, and I think all of us will respond in one of four ways with which our Lord dealt. One is the method of unlimited retaliation. Somebody knocks out your eye, you knock them both out. Somebody knocks out your tooth, knock them all out if you can get to him. If somebody kills your dog, you kill his cow. If he kills your cow, you kill his mule. You kill your mule, you kill him. No limit to the amount of retaliation, unbridled anger, unbridled vengeance. Mankind seems early to have outgrown this idea, but has lapsed back into it with the invention of the atom bomb. This seems to be the principle which dominates the State Department of most so-called civilized nations. You bomb us, we'll obliterate you. You bomb a little city, we will annihilate a whole nation. Unlimited, massive retaliation. Now this was so childish, so barbaric, so beastly, that it never occurred to our Lord that anyone within his hearing would ever resort to it. He just didn't know 20th century man. He picked it up there and began and said, but now wait, if somebody knocks out your eye, don't knock both of his eyes out. The old prophet said, Moses said, one eye for an eye, one tooth for a tooth. If he knocks out your eye, don't knock them both out, just knock out one eye. If he knocks out your tooth, don't knock out all of his teeth, just knock out one tooth. This was the first effort at restraint on the strong. Now, he says, Moses gave you that idea, but it is not enough. Let us move on up to another one. And so the old prophets came along and said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. This was the first glimmerings of limited love. If your neighbor knocks out your tooth, forgive him. But if he's a person of another race or another nation, give him the works. In other words, limit your love to your own little group, your own nation, your own race. This is the rule of limited love. This concept enables man to live together as nations, limiting their love to their own nation, but it does not enable them to live together as a world family. Now, this seems to be the place that most of us really are today. We love America and limit our love to the shores and the boundaries of the United States. I think most of us reflect the idea that's inscribed on an old tombstone down in Mississippi. It says, "Here lies John Henry Simpson. In his lifetime, he killed 99 Indians and lived in the blessed hope of making it 100 until he fell asleep in the arms of Jesus." Now, Indians don't count. 99 of them, you can live in the blessed hope of getting just one more and round it out in an even 100 and still fall asleep in the arms of Jesus. But if you had killed just one white man, you'd fall asleep in a noose. You see, it's all right to kill Indians because we don't care about Indians. But you better not kill a white man. So a nation can drop an atom bomb on brown people, yellow people, and annihilate two whole cities of people, and we give him the Congressional Medal. If he killed one man in the United States, we're given the electric chair. Love your neighbor, those of your own race, your own group. Down in Georgia, some kids working in the civil rights movement ran out of gas. There was an integrated group, and they were out in the country, and two of the white ones decided they'd go for some gas. So they came to a farmer and asked him if he had some gas. "Yes, sure." And he got him out a gallon of gas and said, "Where's your car?" He said, "About a mile up the road." And he said, "Well, get in, I'll take you up there." And he said, "No, we'll walk." And he said, "Why, no, it's too hard. I wouldn't think about letting you walk. Get in." "No," they said, we just rather walk. We need to exercise." "Well," he said, "no, it's too hard. Come on, get in, I'll take you up there." So very reluctantly, the two white kids got in with his white farmer, and they drove along, and finally he said, "Where's your car?" He said, that is right over there." So they stopped and got out, and the farmer realized that it was some of those integrationists. And he became infuriated. He grabbed his can, put it back in their car, and drove off in a huff. If they had been all white, he would have been a fine Southern gentleman. A deacon in the Baptist church, asleep in the arms of Jesus. But now he's dealing with people of a different race, and he can't love those people. Jesus said it is not enough to limit your love to your own nation, to your own race, to your own group. You must respond with love even to those outside of it. Respond with love to those who hate you. This concept enables man to live together, not as nations, but as the human race. We are now at the stage of history where we will either take this step or perish. For we have learned with consummate skill to destroy mankind. We have learned how to efficiently annihilate the human race. But somehow or another, we shrink with horror from the prospects, not of annihilation, but of reconciliation. We will either be reconciled, we shall either love one another, or we shall perish. Now, Jesus did not advocate nonviolence. He was not advocating passive resistance. He does not say, if your enemy slaps you on your right cheek, put on a demonstration protesting your rights to preserve at least the rouge on that particular cheek. It is not commanding us to demand our rights. The only right love has is the right to give it some. Now, this at times may be passive. That is, you may do nothing to a man who opposes you. I was at the Sumter County livestock sale some time back buying some calves that we needed at the farm, and I bought them and was just about getting ready to leave when the town arch segregationist came in. Well, I didn't want to have a consultation with him at that moment, and I kind of shrunk down behind everybody else and looked for a mouse hole, but couldn't find one. And finally he came in and looked all around and saw me. And he came over and stood about 2 or 3 feet in front of me and yelled at the top of his voice, even above the noise of the auctioneer, and finally he came in and looked all around and saw me. And he came over and stood about 2 or 3 feet in front of me and yelled at the top of his voice, even above the noise of the auctioneer, "Yeah, that old Jersey fellow is, folks. We ain't killed him yet, but we can kill him now. We got him here by himself." Well, I started looking for even a knothole to get through at that time, and couldn't find one. And then he looked at me, and he raised his voice again. He said, "You ain't nothing but a..." Well, he made a positive statement. He made a positive statement that on my mama's side, I had some canine ancestors. Now, down where I come from, when somebody attributes to you that kind of pedigree, you're supposed to respond. And I felt my fist getting in the position to respond. And then about that time, he used God's name and called me that kind of gave me that kind of a pedigree. And then he took a little deeper breath and called me something else, and I noticed that while he didn't have any teeth, he did have tonsils. And I thought that this would be a nice time to perform a public tonsillectomy. But somehow God gave me the power to restrain myself, and the little fella kept on calling me increasingly long names. I didn't know there were that many species around until he called me those. Well, he finally gave up and went outside, and there was a great big old 200-pound farmer sitting next to me, and I noticed every time this fellow would call me by one of those names, this farmer would kind of do like that, and this big old farmer moved over next to me and said, "You know what?" And I thought he was getting ready to take up what his little fella just left off. I said, "What?" He said, "I want to know how come you didn't hit that little fella." He said, "You could have beat him. You could have really whooped him if with one arm tied behind your back." I said, "I think that is a correct appraisal of the situation." He said, "Well, how come you didn't hit him?" I said, "My friend, there's two reasons why I didn't hit him. One's purely selfish. If I'd hit that little segregationist, everybody in this sale barn would have jumped on me and mopped up the floor with me. And I just don't want my wife married to a mop. Now, that's one reason I didn't hit him. But the real reason was I'm trying to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And he has taught me to love my enemies." And I said, "Now, while I must confess, I had the minimum amount of love for this little fellow. At least I did him no harm." And this old fellow said, "Is that what it means to be a Christian?" I said, "Friend, that isn't all that it means, but that's a part of it. We sat for a while talking about being a Christian. So I might say that it is not enough to just merely not harm your enemy. Somehow or another, we must go beyond that. Love is not merely a weapon. It is not a strategy. And it may or may not work. To do good to those who hate you is such stupendous folly, it can't be expected to work. Love didn't work for Jesus. No man has ever loved as he loved, but it didn't work. He wound up on a cross. And yet it does work if your motive is not to make it work. Love works in the home, but if you say, well, you know, it really works to love your wife. If you love her, she'll darn your socks and bake you pie every day. If that is the motive for love, I doubt that your wife will darn your socks or bake you pie. But love does work. I think Abraham Lincoln said it so well when one day old Thaddeus Stephen, a very bitter man from Massachusetts who was in the cabinet, after the war was over, there was much sentiment in the North to just crush the South. Thaddeus Stephen shared this. One day when Mr. Lincoln was advocating binding up the wounds of the nation, forgiveness, reconciliation, old Thaddeus Stephen pounded the table and said, Mr. Lincoln, I think enemies ought to be destroyed. Mr. Lincoln quietly said, Mr. Stephen, do not I destroy my enemy when I make him my friend? In the long run, it is the only way that really does work. For when the cards are all in and the final chapter of history is written, when time is rolled out as a garment, and God is all and in all, in that final day, it will be the peacemakers, not the warriors, who will be called the sons of God.
I think Clarence Jordan gives you some sense, and I think his style is refreshing. Maybe the one disadvantage of something like that is it will seem so overly dramatic and beyond our everyday life. So I want to tell you a couple stories which bring it more down to where we live. When people hear that the topic is nonviolent, sometimes they want to know the techniques of that. I do not think that's the place to start. Or to get into academic discussions, almost always within the first 5 minutes, but what if you're dealing with an Adolf Hitler, and we get into Bonhoeffer and Hitler and some other things, and that's fine to do. I don't think that's the place to start. Some sense of it being a way of life, not a tactic. Some sense of what Jordan meant when he said the only right love has is the right to give itself. Some understanding of the radical nature of the scandal of the cross. In Washington, D.C., we had a small group of people. We were called the Community of Christ, and we were trying to live out what faithfulness meant in the 1960s in the midst of that city. By having programs that brought together people of different races, and by siding with the poor and the oppressed, we therefore made some enemies. One neighbor across the street from us continued to live as a enemy and a one-woman CIA about our activities. She went to my bishop and said, he doesn't look like a preacher. I want to know, is he in fact a member of the clergy roster of the American Lutheran Church? And my bishop had to say I was one of his pastors. In the midst of that, she went into the code of Washington. If she ever was on the side of goodness and right, our world could be saved. She is one of the most conscientious workers I've ever seen. She found in the code that was some 40 years old that you could not tutor more than three people at a time. This was back in the days when people gave music lessons in their home, and it was a way to protect the neighborhood. What she did was to bring that no more than three in a home at one time tutoring covenant and have one of our members arrested because he had 15 boys in his basement at night building model airplanes. The main reason that she was opposed to it is the kids were black and that he lived next door to her. So they came by her house and into his house, and this was great offense. In the midst of all, I'll tell you the happy ending to that story so that you know, so that I don't leave that one hanging. I called a good friend who was an excellent lawyer. He happened to be Jewish, but he thrived on things like this. I don't know exactly what he did. The scenario I have is that he called the city police and the judge and said, I want to know when the case is coming up. I'm willing to defend the man, the criminal, who's helping small boys build model airplanes in his basement, and the Washington Post would like to cover it. I don't know. Anyway, the police department called Bob the next day and said, skip it. It's all off. Forget it. So anyway, it was settled very quickly. The point I want you to know is when, in the middle of that hearing business, before the actual arrest and warrant was delivered, they both had to go to the city building, and at the end of the hearing, since they lived next door to one another, since she did not have a car, and Bob did, he said, may I drive you home, Miss McCarran? And that was without any strategy at all. That was just Bob. That was the most natural thing in the world. And nothing got her more upset than his saying, can I drive you home? We live next door to one another. Bob came by what we're talking about so naturally that it was always fun to see. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. I'll tell a story on my wife. When we moved to West Virginia, we came into a culture that was different from ours, and we put up no hunting signs on our farm. Some of the people who for a long time had walked across our farm and hunted did not understand that. They didn't understand a lot of things that we did, but that was one of them. And a brother of a former owner of our farm, who we had heard about by reputation, came one day in a slight drizzle, parked his truck outside of our fence. There's a fence that kind of is the inner fence on farms in West Virginia. He stayed outside of that. Mary went out. He rolled down the window, so she was in the rain and he was in the cab of his truck. And she said, hi, who are you? He said, I'm number three. And she said, well, come on, you must have a name. And it turned out he was the third son of the Simmons family and he was always called the number three. We found out later that his name was Harlan, but he never told her. He said, I've always hunted on the place and I'm going to continue to hunt on the place. And Mary said, well, we prefer that you didn't. And he said, you can get the sheriff and bring him out here to try to run me off, but he won't run me off. Mary said, we wouldn't call the sheriff. We just are asking that you not. He said, you can get a gun and shoot, and you will not get rid of me. She said, we don't own a gun. We don't intend to. We wouldn't shoot anybody if we did. We're just asking people not to. Well, for about 20 minutes, he tried to get a fight, which is what you should have gotten with those kinds of words. He never got one. After 20 minutes, he rolled up the window, and just before it got to the top, he said, hope you folks will be happy here. And off he ran. To my knowledge, Harlan has never hunted on our land. I have sobered him up and got him back in front of his steering wheel and home, but I don't think he's ever hunted on our land. I want to tell one a little different, and I don't mean to get it into the more than our lifestyle drama, but it is a little different. I don't think this country really heard the stories of the civil rights movement. I don't think the newspaper accurately told the stories. They gave the headlines, yes, they gave the incidents, but I'd like to give you what I think was the essence of that, and I don't think this country ever heard that. There was a young Quaker from Washington, D.C., who went into the South, like the integrationists that Clarence Jordan talked about. And the strategy at that time was that there were people who felt that it was morally wrong to exclude blacks from lunch counters. Just the basis of the color of your skin being why you couldn't sit down and have a Coke. And in order to nonviolently protest against that. You walked through that barrier, which you said was immoral, even though you might be subject to arrest. In other words, your action was saying something about that law. So blacks and whites sat down and they both ordered a Coke. It was called the sit-ins. And they were very controversial in the South when that happened. David described, when he came back to D.C., an incident that happened down there. He sat down at a lunch counter next to a black friend, and he felt in his back an unmistakable sharp object, namely a knife, and so he turned. Now, I told you that I didn't think it was best to start with a lecture on the techniques of nonviolence, and I'm not going to do that. I do want you to know that if there is anything that's part of an understanding of nonviolence, it's when you're in a conflict situation, you personalize it as much as you can. You would always face the person and assume you are talking to another fellow human being. And he looked him right in the eye. If there is another consistent premise to nonviolence, that would be it. Right in the eye. No looking away, but right in the eye. And he spoke softly. If there's another consistent thing, it would be to always bring it down and have it soft and gentle. Then he said, friend, and you miss the whole evening if you don't understand that he meant that. If you can't mean that, don't go to school for the techniques of nonviolence. You just missed the whole point. He meant that, friend. Whether you push the knife, now it was at his heart, whether you push the knife in or not is obviously up to you. It isn't up to me. I want you to know, in either event, I love you. And the guy's hand shook, and the knife fell, and he ran from the drugstore, whipped by a power that he did not understand. What I want you to know is it is a power. It is not the absence of power. I also want you to know, if you take all of the instances in the world's history, the times of the knife going in probably outnumber the times of the hand shaking and the knife dropping. Don't think we don't have adequate warning about that. Don't think that it's a new way to win without you getting hurt, but it is a power. I think that's the story of the civil rights movement. At the essence of what nonviolent resistance meant in the South was an understanding of what we've been talking about tonight. The newspapers didn't carry that often enough. I'm going to tell you one more story, and then it's sauna time. I have a good friend who was a Paulist priest. I guess the most consistent nonviolent person that I know. He was an investment broker with a Jaguar car and everything else in California, and he got converted one time on the beach to Jesus. And he went in to tell his boss why he was leaving. And his boss said, come on up, we'll have a drink, and we'll raise your salary, and we'll talk about it. And Ed told him again why he was leaving, and the drink wouldn't do any good. And the boss said at the end of about 10 minutes, you've called into question everything I stand for. Ed said, I know, that's why I'm leaving. And so he became a Paulist priest, and he lived in D.C., and he even gave up the $40 a month stipend that the Paulists were willing to send him. He lived off the streets with the poor of the streets. And he continued to align himself with the poor and the oppressed, and continued to be nonviolent. He made the paper, that's what I'm going to tell you about, not because that's the highest tribute I can give to him, but it is an illustration of nonviolence that goes beyond what we've talked about, and I didn't want you to think it was only on the personal level. Ed felt that the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. was violent in a couple ways. First of all, that they had the wrong priorities on the church's money going for lots of things other than poor people. That was a violence, and that the books were closed to the lay people of the church, and that nobody could find out how much money the Archdiocese had or the Catholic Church has. We kind of knew they owned Watergate and a lot of apartments, but nobody really knew. Ed, as a priest, thought that the people ought to know what the church had and how it was going to be spent. So there was a good man who was the Archbishop. In fact, now he's kicked upstairs and is in Rome, and his picture was just in Time magazine. William Baum, a good man. I mean that. I'm not facetious about it. Ed wrote him a letter, asked for two things. Asked that the books of the diocese be opened, and asked for some programs of really poor people that they be funded instead of the Roman Catholic Church putting their money in lots of other things. And he got nowhere. He asked for an audience, could not get it. He felt strongly enough that he did what Gandhi said to do very rarely. So I will give that as a preliminary, but I think Ed had lived nonviolently long enough that he knew what he was doing, and that for him it was not some kind of cheap tactic. He announced to a few friends, he didn't try to make a big public thing out of it, he announced to a few friends and to the Archbishop and to the church that he was going to fast until resolution. Most people who knew him assumed that meant till death, and I know it did, but he started fasting. By the providence of God, or the stupidity of some bureaucrats in the Roman Catholic Church, or chance, I'll let you take your choice, about the 14th day of the fast, the Archdiocese bought a $525,000 house for Mr. Baum to live in. And you might know he's a bachelor, right? A bishop? He was going to be alone in a house that the United States government had turned down for our vice president because it was too auspicious. It was an incredible move in the midst of Ed Guinan's fast. Well, the paper picked up on Ed Guinan, who had now lost 20 pounds, and this house. And little nuns who had never protested before in their life started walking in front of this house. And the mail, which had come to Ed up until then, said, "You're a kook, and I'm embarrassed that I'm a Catholic." Now the mail said, "We thought you were nuts." You're not nuts. The church is nuts, but you're not nuts. And it took trucks to bring the mail to Archbishop Baum. And some suburban people said, "We're not going to give to this church if that's the way you're going to spend your money." Now the church listened. And Ed, on the 24th day, when the Archbishop opened the books in a way that they had never been opened before, sold the house, which never again has been looked at by the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., and in fact found some money for two or three programs. When he announced that, I was with Ed when he ate his first soft-boiled egg and broke the fast. That's a power. I'm not sure you'll always have that kind of success story. It's one that I know because I knew him well and could celebrate the soft-boiled egg with him. I just think, unless we understand that when Jesus promised power through the radical nature of crucified love, he was talking about the kind of thing we were talking about tonight. And don't let the fact that it has never been a majority opinion in the world, or is so easily knocked down and written off as weakness, cowardice, or some combination of these three, the one thing I want you to go from tonight, go from here with, is to underline that and say none of the above. And to understand satyagraha as whatever word is best for you, truth power, soul power, the kind of power that I think is still the most radical power in the world.